Happening now, Ukraine retaking key territory from Kremlin forces in towns around the major northern Ukrainian city of Kharkiv, pushing Putin's army closer and closer to the Russian border. We're also following breaking news here in Washington up on Capitol Hill. A vote to preserve abortion rights just failed in the United States Senate. Lawmakers erupting in protest as Roe versus Wade hangs in the balance at the U.S. Supreme Court. Former Obama Attorney General Eric Holder joins me live this hour. Also tonight, new details on an astonishing emergency landing by an untrained airplane passenger forced to take the helm after the pilot was incapacitated. The air traffic controller who helped guide the plane to safety is taking CNN inside the harrowing ordeal. We want to welcome our viewers here in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer. You're in the Situation Room. Tonight, Ukraine is claiming several victories in the hotly contested terrain around Kharkiv, a major city just miles from the Russian border. CNN's Scott McLean is on the ground for us in Lviv with more on the Ukrainian counteroffensive. CNN's Oren Lieberman is joining us live from the Pentagon with a new U.S. assessment from top U.S. defense officials. But let's begin with Scott for more on the developments near Kharkiv. Scott, this is highly important territory near a pivotal city, and Ukraine now says it has the upper hand.
Exactly, Wolf. They are starting to take back towns and villages outside of Kharkiv. In some places, Wolf, they say that they are mere miles from the Russian border, a border that the Ukrainians say the Russians have amassed a huge amount of troops on, 20 battalion tactical groups, which is about 18,000 troops. So clearly, the Russians could strike back at any moment. The Ukrainians are urging civilians not to return back to these retaken villages and towns because they're heavily mined. And also, they are still very much within Russian artillery range. Russia, though, is also within artillery range now for Ukrainian shelling. And the governor of the Belgorod region in Russia says that for the first time, a civilian was killed by Ukrainian shelling in a village about 6 miles inside of the border. Now, this is not the first time that there's been explosions in that region, though the Ukrainians have not been keen to take responsibility for them. And Wolf, in the southern part of the country, in the Kherson region, the Kremlin-appointed leaders of this occupied territory are planning to put in a formal request to join the Russian Federation without any kind of referendum. They say that they could be issuing passports and citizenship documents by the end of the year. The Kremlin says that it is the people of Kherson who should be deciding what to do, though they're not calling for a referendum either.
Scott, as you know, Ukraine now says the latest shipments of foreign weapons supplied by the U.S. and other NATO partners have already started to arrive at the front lines. What kind of impact is all this having?
Yeah, the Ukrainians say that they're getting into a rhythm, getting into a flow of these weapons shipments and then delivery throughout the country. The United States, the Pentagon, says that 89 out of the 90 howitzers, for instance, that it's pledged Ukraine are already inside of the country. These are modern-day artillery systems. Also consider that Russia has a troops advantage. They have 4.5 times the number of troops at their disposal compared to the Ukrainians. But at least when it comes to military hardware, the Ukrainians now say that it's getting to the point where the Russians no longer have a clear advantage when it comes to equipment. Wolf?
Very interesting. All right, Scott McLean on the scene for us. Thank you very much. The Russian assault on Kharkiv flattened countless buildings and left scores of civilians, men, women, and children, dead Ukrainians. CNN's Nick Payton Walsh has the story of one Ukrainian woman who survived for hours buried beneath the rubble after a Russian airstrike.
Sometimes places that speak only of death throw up a jewel of life. This is the first time Ayuna has stood in this spot. Since 72 days ago, she was dragged out from the rubble here. Her husband, Andrei, had been scouring it, looking for her, for 3 hours. She remembers the cupboard.
That was where I was standing.
The multiple rocket attack on this, the Kharkiv Regional Administration, was an early sign of the ferocious, cowardly brutality Russia would unleash on civilian targets. This is Ayuna then. She had been serving coffee and cookies to soldiers, saw a flash and curled into a ball.
Какой-то жуткий страх, прямо так физически я чувствую волнение и.
I feel a physical manifestation of fear. I don't like cookies anymore. A box fell on me, and I remember the smell.
She asks to step away, saying she's sick with butterflies, like she hasn't felt since before races when she used to swim professionally. Andrei picks up the story.
When I heard her voice, I was crawling across the rubble, and the emergency services were trying to kick me out. I pulled a man out and then heard her. I did not plan to leave her here.
The soldiers waiting in the corridor outside from her died. The young women in the basement below her died, their bodies not found for 3 weeks. Yet somehow, the concrete here fell, shielding Ayuna.
I knew I was alive, in pain but nothing broken, but was worried I would be left and never be heard. The first time they heard me, they started to get me out, and the second missile came, and I was properly trapped.
A rescuer eventually heard her.
Andrei got closer, and I said it was me, and he cried. They said they shouldn't lift the baton on me, but Andrei did, alone. It got easier to breathe. I was surprised as I thought I was still at ground level. The ambulance guy said, "It's your second birthday. You're alive."
Fragments of a Kharkiv now past pepper this shell, cleaning up and trying to sweep away its trauma.
I sleep with the lights on, and when there's a loud car or, God forbid, a jet plane, I brace. The nightmares that I'm again lying there and shivering cold, and that nobody hears my cries, that also stops me from sleeping.
Ayuna was born in Russia, but can no longer talk to her relatives there. She says they believe Russian state media's absurd claims. This is a limited operation against Nazis.
They say it was my stupidity and that I don't need to be here. I hope when time passes, our children can talk, but I can't talk to them now. Russia has lost its mind and cannot control its president. They are all each responsible, every citizen.
The story here, not of ruins, loss, or burial in dust, but instead of a feverish energy that burns through the building's bones as Kharkiv gets to decide where its pieces fall now. Nick Payton-Walsh, CNN, Kharkiv, Ukraine.
Nick, thank you very, very much. Now to CNN's Oren Lieberman is over at the Pentagon. Oren, I understand top U.S. defense officials, they are reacting today publicly to Russia's use of these hypersonic missiles in Ukraine. The first time these weapons have been used in combat, we're told. What did they say?
The U.S. has watched all of the launches of hypersonic missiles from the Russians, not only to learn about the use of such weapons in combat. The top U.S. general says the first time they've been used in combat anywhere, but also to learn about the capabilities of the Russian military. Now, according to Russian claims and U.S. assessments, Russia has used a few different kinds of hypersonic missiles, mostly essentially short-range ballistic missile, the Tochka, the Iskander, those are ground-launched, as well as the Kinzhal, which is an air-launched version of those missiles. But despite all of the hype around these and the growing concern you hear in the U.S., especially among politicians, that the U.S. is falling behind Russia and China when it comes to hypersonic developments, the conclusion was that these weren't the game changer that many had feared they would be if they were used on the battlefield.
But other than the speed of the weapon, in terms of its effect on a given target, we are not seeing really significant or game-changing effects to date with the delivery of the small number of hypersonics that the Russians have used.
The Pentagon says that Russia has used somewhere between 10 and 12 hypersonic missiles since this war began about 2.5 months ago. As for why, that remains pretty much an open question, but they believe it might be an indication that Russia is running out of smart weapons, precision-guided munitions, and has had to come to these hypersonic weapons to simply carry out their attacks. They also note, Wolf, that the targets are essentially structures or buildings, not dynamic moving targets, and that tells you something about Russia's inability to hit moving targets, perhaps. Wolf?
Yeah, very significant information. Oren Lieberman at the Pentagon, thank you. Just ahead, CNN is now learning new information about potential high-profile witnesses who could appear at public January 6th Select Committee hearings next month. A key member of the panel, Congressman Adam Schiff. He's standing by live. He will join us when we come back. We're following breaking news. We now have new information about next month's public January 6th Select Committee hearings. Sources tell CNN the panel is finalizing its witness list, which could include some high-profile figures in the investigation. Our congressional correspondent, Ryan Nobles, is joining us live from Capitol Hill right now. Ryan, tell our viewers what you're learning.
Yeah, that's right, Wolf. These hearings now less than a month away, and they are important to the January 6th Select Committee because it's going to be the first time that they really present with a great deal of specificity this work that they've been doing largely behind closed doors for the better part of 10 months. And you're right. At this point, they have not finalized that witness list. As far as we've learned, they've not even reached out to potential witnesses, but there are a number of people that they've already talked to behind closed doors who they might want to bring some of that testimony out into the light. People like the former acting attorney general, Jeffrey Rosen, his deputy, Richard Donahue, as well as people that were close to the former vice president, Mike Pence, including his chief of staff, Mark Short, and his chief counsel, Greg Jacob. Now, there's also some witnesses who the committee has spoken to who may not be interested in coming forward and speaking publicly. But the committee does have a way around that as well. People like Ivanka Trump, her husband, Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of the former president, and his son, Donald Trump Jr. The committee, we've learned, has videotaped many of these depositions. And there's always the possibility that if these folks are not brought forward to testify publicly, that the committee could play clips of this witness testimony. And we've been told for some time that videotape and other elements will be a big part of this multimedia presentation when it all happens. And we've also learned that they've started to zero in on some topics that they want to cover during these hearings. There's going to be eight in total, including what President Trump was doing during the riot. There's a lot of time that is unaccounted for in the president's schedule. Also, the efforts to pull false election fraud claims, how law enforcement responded to the riot on that day, and then, of course, the organizing and financing of the January 6th rally. You know, Wolf, the committee has taken in so much information, and this is their opportunity to distill some of that information and put together some of the things that they've learned and present it to the American people. But as they get these presentations together, they are still taking in more information. The National Archives announcing today that they are releasing an eighth tranche of documents from the Trump White House, some 23,000 emails and attachments that will soon be in the hands of the committee. So even as they are sifting through the thousands and thousands of documents they already have, Wolf, they're still taking in more information, and they're also continuing interviews and depositions of many potential witnesses.
Yeah, starting Wolf, early next month, we'll start seeing some of the evidence that the Select Committee has collected, and these hearings no doubt will be televised. We'll watch them very, very closely. Ryan Nobles up on Capitol Hill, thanks very much. Let's bring in a key member of the January 6th Select Committee, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Congressman Adam Schiff of California. Congressman, thank you so much for joining us. Will these hearings lay out new insight into the insurrection? Will they reveal, for example, details that have so far not been made public?
Without a doubt, there will be new information and new details. Certainly the public is aware of a lot of information already through a lot of impressive reporting about the multiple lines of effort to overturn the presidential election. But we expect in these, you know, multimedia presentations that include live testimony, video, audio, documentary evidence, to provide a kind of important texture to this nefarious effort for the first time in our history to overturn a presidential election, interfere with the peaceful transfer of power. We want to expose the actions of the malefactors to the public scrutiny.
So what is the strategy, Congressman, for the witnesses who are refusing to testify publicly? They've testified behind closed doors, but publicly. Are you willing, for example, to agree to ground rules to get some of these reluctant witnesses to speak out during these televised hearings?
Well, you know, Wolf, we'll have to take it on a case-by-case basis. The reality is we have so much information. The challenge is to decide, okay, these are the most important witnesses, these are the most important pieces of evidence. We do have to obviously hone things down, but
It is, I think, essential to tell the story, the complete story, to the American people. It wasn't just about January 6th. That was the violent culmination of lots of different efforts to overturn the election, to coerce state legislators and local elections officials through bogus litigation, through pressure campaign on the vice president, through voting to overturn the election in the House of Representatives. So we want to lay out that whole picture for the country.
Will the American public, Congressman, see video clips from the taped interviews your committee has already conducted with witnesses? And we're talking about several witnesses, including Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka Trump, Jared Kushner, for example.
We will certainly consider using evidence that came from the depositions in a variety of different forms. We want to make this visually interesting to the viewing public. And we're not going to be able to call all the witnesses because we've interviewed hundreds of them. So I think it'll be a combination of live testimony. It may be some videotaped interviews. It may be audio tapes. It may be TV clips. I think you'll see really a clever integration of these different sources of information to tell the story and tell it in an easily digestible form.
I'm really looking forward to these public televised hearings. Let me turn, while I have you, Congressman, to Ukraine. You're the chairman of the Intelligence Committee. The House just passed a $40 billion Ukraine aid package. It's now waiting on a Senate vote and waiting, of course, for President Biden's signature after the Senate passes it. Will this be enough, and will it arrive fast enough to tip the scales on the battlefield in Ukraine's favor?
It will arrive quick enough if we can get the Senate to act and we can get that over to the president. I can tell you that the aid that we have approved thus far has moved very quickly from congressional approval to presidential approval and onto the battlefield and dispersed to where it needs to go in Ukraine. So those supply lines are now well orchestrated, and Ukrainians have, I think, done an extraordinary job in getting the material to their fighters and to defend the country. Will this ultimately be the last? It really depends on how long the conflict goes on. But I think the more that we do now, the quicker we can bring this to an end. Once Putin realizes he is not going to accomplish his objectives there, and the costs to Russia have simply become too high. Costs in terms of Russian lives and costs in terms of the sanctions and the impact on the Russian economy and the Russian people.
Yeah, so far the delivery of these javelins, these howitzers, the Stingers, they have moved very, very quickly. Congressman Adam Schiff, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, inflation here in the United States at a 40-year high and causing real financial hardship for millions of Americans. We're going to take a closer look at the hard choices some are having to make. We'll be right back. President Biden is trying to shift focus to his predecessor as the United States faces the highest inflation in 40 years. Let's go to our chief White House correspondent, Caitlin Collins. Caitlin, what's the latest over there?
Yeah, Wolf, the president said today that he is heartened by the modest decrease in prices that this new information released by the federal government today showed. But the fact of the matter is he still believes that these inflation numbers are way too high. And that includes food prices, Wolf, which we are seeing in this report rose 0.9% in the month of April from the previous month. And that is what took President Biden to a farm in Illinois today, where he was talking about efforts that they are taking to try to boost food production here in the United States. Not just an issue here, but also one globally, as the president was praising farmers that he was meeting with while on the ground in Illinois. But Wolf, also, he is trying to push this debate back on Republicans who have been sharply critical of his handling of the economy, of the inflation rates that we have seen and the concerns that officials have had. And so later in Chicago, he even brought up his predecessor and talked about his handling of what's happening right now.
Under my predecessor, the great MAGA king, the deficit increased every single year he was president. They don't want to solve inflation by lowering the cost. They want to solve it by raising taxes and lowering your income.
That comment there, obviously a dig at Senator Rick Scott and an economic proposal that he put out. We should note it is one that has been rejected by people like Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Of course, this is still expected to be the debate that you are going to see the president pursuing, Wolf, over the next 6 months. Now that, of course, as these inflation numbers are still as high as they are, despite coming down, are dominating the political landscape.
Yes, they are. Caitlin Collins at the White House, thank you. With inflation now at a 40-year high here in the United States, the financial impact is painful for many Americans and forcing some to make very hard choices. CNN's Brian Todd is working this part of the story for us. Brian, almost all of Americans' daily necessities are still much more expensive than they were, what, a year ago?
That's right, Wolf. There's been almost no break for Americans, and places like this grocery store seem to be where consumers are feeling it the most.
At a grocery store in Northeast D.C., shoppers are more than a little fed up with food prices.
You know, it's hard. You know, it's hard trying to balance, you know, what you need and what you want.
Everything from soda to meats to vegetables. Well, everything's just increased.
According to new government figures, annual inflation did ease off a bit last month, but is still near a 40-year high. Prices rising 8.3% for the year ending in April, slightly lower than the 8.5% rise through March. And food was one of the biggest factors, along with shelter. In just a month, meat, poultry, fish, and eggs went up 1.4%, with eggs by themselves spiking 10.3%.
What have you noticed most has gone up?
Yeah, it would be the eggs, because a while ago they were very cheap.
And housing costs for renters and owners went up 0.5% for the third month in a row, consumers taking a big hit each month.
The typical American household is spending $450 more now than a year ago to buy the same goods and services, and that's because of the higher inflation. So this is incredibly painful.
Gas prices dipped last month but are now back to setting records, the national average for regular at $4.40 a gallon, up $1.40 since a year ago.
So every day you drive by, it's one price, and within a matter of hours, it'll jump up again.
Analysts say with inflation this high, millions of American families already struggling to make ends meet due to the pandemic may still have to make tough choices.
It really will mean that some people might actually have to skip a meal. Maybe, you know, they can't feed their children the way they want to. They will perhaps not be able to cover their rent or all of their rent.
But on the bright side, at least one top economist says there could be relief in sight.
Inflation is peaking. I think the painfully high inflation is due to the pandemic and to the Russian invasion. If those things don't go off the rails, then I think we will see inflation lowered by the end of the year and certainly by this time next year.
Analyst Mark Zandi says that does not mean that the price of everything is just going to come down. He says we should get used to high prices for things like groceries. But he says what will actually come down, the price of gasoline. And he believes that before the end of the year, the prices of new cars are going to start to come down as some of those supply chain issues get ironed out. Wolf?
Well, let's hope. Brian Todd reporting for us. Thank you very much. Good explanation. Just ahead, Ukraine claims pivotal territory around the northern city of Kharkiv has been liberated from Kremlin forces. Can the Ukrainians push Putin's army all the way back to the Russian border? The former Ukrainian prime minister standing by live. He will join us when we come back. Just into CNN, new images showing Russian pontoon bridges obliterated by Ukrainian artillery strikes. Kremlin forces were trying to cross a key strategic river in eastern Ukraine, but Ukrainian attacks have frustrated those Russian attempts, at least so far. For more on that, let's bring in the former Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk. Prime Minister, thank you so much for joining us. As you know, Ukraine is clearly having some impressive success in the eastern part of the country. It says it's recaptured some territory around Kharkiv. But how much of the eastern Donbas region does Russia now control?
Well, that's true. Ukrainian army already launched a number of counter-offensive operations, and we are doing quite well. And I do really commend the Biden administration and bipartisan support. President Biden already signed a land lease act into law, and we expect that U.S. Congress is to pass and President Biden is to sign $40 billion support act of Ukraine. And this really helps. On the other hand, Wolf, look, I want to be very realistic. Putin decided actually to wage a new type of war, which is war of attrition. This is to be a long-lasting war. And we are not to underestimate this bloody Nazi-style dictator Putin. So that's the reason why so much needed support of Ukrainian military that is delivered by the United States is of crucial importance. I just got the report that American-made howitzers M3777 are already at the front lines, and they are defending Ukraine. So, on the one hand, we launched a counteroffensive. On the other hand, we are not to underestimate Putin and his bloody military.
You may have heard President Zelensky today say, and I'm quoting him now, with each new Bucha, with each new Mariupol, the desire to negotiate with Russia, he says, disappears. Instead of talks, will Ukraine keep pushing for a more decisive military victory to gain leverage for some deal down the road?
Well, here is the thing. Last month, we discussed whether there is any chance for a diplomatic solution. I was, I am, and I will be very skeptical about any kind of diplomatic solution with Russia. They had a number of options, and they had a number of window opportunities, not even to wage this war. But Putin, you know, there is no even off-ramp for Putin because he cornered himself, and that's the biggest problem. So I believe the only chance for us to get to cut any kind of deal is to win at the battlefield. The only victory is the victory of Ukrainian military, which is to reclaim the territories that have been occupied by the Russian military. And only afterwards, Putin maybe to realize that there is no other option rather than to push back and to sit at some kind of negotiating table and to hammer out the deal. But the deal is very clear. Ukraine is to restore its territorial integrity, and Russia is to respect Ukraine as an independent country.
And the speedy delivery of that U.S. weaponry, the howitzers, and all the other equipment, that will certainly help in your efforts. So the former Ukrainian Prime Minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk.
No doubt.
Thank you so much for joining us. I want to continue our conversations down the road. Appreciate it very, very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's more breaking news coming up next. A key vote to protect access to abortion here in the United States fails in the Senate, just ahead of a possible Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe versus Wade. We're going to talk about that and more with the former Obama Attorney General, Eric Holder. He's standing by live. Plus, new details of how an air traffic controller talked a man who had never flown a plane to a safe landing after the pilot passed out. Breaking news tonight, a key procedural vote to protect access to abortion has just failed in the United States Senate by a vote of 49-51, with Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia joining Republicans to block the measure from advancing. This comes as a leaked draft shows the Supreme Court's new conservative majority likely to overturn Roe versus Wade, the ruling that declared a right to abortion almost 50 years ago. Let's talk about this and more with the former Obama Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder. Attorney General, thank you so much for joining us. Your new book is entitled Our Unfinished March, The Violent Past and Imperiled Future of the Vote, A History, A Crisis, A Plan. Thanks so much, Attorney General, for writing this book. Thanks so much for joining us. You say you'd be surprised if the final opinion in the Supreme Court reflects the language in Justice Alito's original draft. But even if the tone is watered down a bit, do you expect the U.S. Supreme Court to ultimately overturn Roe versus Wade?
I think the point you make is a good one. Whatever I say about the language is secondary to what I think the court is likely to do, which is to overturn Roe versus Wade, turn its back on precedent, turn its back on the reliance that people have put into the Roe decision over the course of the last almost 50 years. This is going to have a seismic impact on our nation, and I think have a negative impact on the views of many people with regard to the legitimacy of the Supreme Court.
Because in your new book, which I've gone through, obviously, you call this, and I'm quoting now, you call this, quote, stolen Supreme Court, your words. You describe a, quote, illegitimate conservative majority. Have you, the former Attorney General of the United States, lost faith in the legitimacy of the U.S. Supreme Court?
I wouldn't say I've lost total faith in the legitimacy of the court. And yet, if Merrick Garland had had an opportunity to have a hearing and had been confirmed. And if we had not rushed to have Amy Coney Barrett confirmed while people were voting, you would now have a 5-4 Supreme Court progressives as opposed to conservatives. And you would be in a fundamental place with regard to this decision concerning Roe versus Wade, and also with regard to a whole range of other issues that the court has decided since the time that Merrick Garland should have been on the court.
As you know, in Florida right now, it looks like an injunction is coming to block Governor Ron DeSantis's congressional map. This over concerns it would illegally harm black voters in Florida. But DeSantis is already gearing up to appeal. When it comes to this erosion of voting rights, and you write a lot about it in your new book, do you feel like you've got a garden hose to fight a forest fire?
I think we actually have, and we don't understand as Americans, we actually have the necessary tools to fight, as you describe, this forest fire of voter suppression. What happened in Florida today is an indication of when people gather together, go to court, ask judges to look at what people in the executive branch or somebody like DeSantis is trying to do, and then DeSantis gets knocked down. You've seen people around the country put in place independent commissions to do the redistricting, to fight gerrymandering. It really will involve, as we have seen, as we talk about in the book, when ordinary people, so-called ordinary people, get together and really commit themselves, dedicate themselves, prepare to sacrifice, you can make fundamental structural changes to the United States government. And that is what is called upon us to do right now. This is a democracy that is at risk, a democracy that is in peril, but not one that cannot be saved.
Well, you write a lot about your fears about democracy in America, and you warn in your new book that America could go down a path where you, and I'm quoting you now, a minority party that doesn't represent the interests or the desires of the people would hold on to power by rigging the system in its favor. That's a direct quote from you. Do you believe the country is already there?
I'm not sure we're already there, but we certainly have. We see instances of minority rule in a variety of states as a result of partisan and racial gerrymandering, where you have these abortion laws being passed that are not supported by the majority of the people in those states, and yet legislators vote for them, knowing that they are in safe gerrymandered districts and they face no electoral consequence for them. I'm also worried about how elections could be rigged, given what we have seen grow out of the fallacies of January the 6th and this notion of a stolen election, this notion of voters casting votes illegally. All of that is simply not bolstered by the facts. And yet policies are being put in place, people, career people being removed from key election positions and replaced by partisans. And I have to add, to be fair, some really good Republican career folks like that guy Vandeveld in Michigan, potentially Raffensperger in Georgia, people who were Republicans and simply did their jobs. And as a result of doing their jobs, they're being removed by their parties.
The former Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for writing Our Unfinished March, The Violent Past and Imperiled Future of the Vote, A History, A Crisis, A Plan. There's the cover. Thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Wolf.
Other news we're following tonight. The U.S. State Department is strongly condemning the killing of a Palestinian-American journalist who was shot while covering an Israeli military operation. CNN's Hadass Gold is joining us from Jerusalem right now. Hadass, Israel says it's investigating the killing. What more are you learning tonight?
Well, Wolf, I'm standing outside of the house of Shireen Abu Akleh. She is the veteran Al Jazeera correspondent who was shot and killed today while on assignment, while covering an Israeli military operation, what the IDF is saying was a counterterrorism operation in the West Bank town of Jenin. Very disturbing video we are seeing of right after she was shot shows that she was very clearly wearing a protective vest and a helmet with the big words press across that vest. These are the things that we see so many journalists wearing in conflict zones. Her producer, Ali Al-Samoudi, was also shot, but he is in stable condition. And he is saying that it was Israeli forces that shot at them. And he is saying saying that there was no Palestinian militants directly near them. Now, Al Jazeera is directly blaming Israeli forces for Shireen's death. They're calling on the international community to hold them to account. Now, the Israeli Defense Forces are saying, as I was saying earlier, that they were operating in the area as part of a counterterrorism operation. They say that they came under heavy fire. There is now calls for an investigation. The Israeli military, although initially suggesting potentially that it was Palestinian militants who Shireen got caught up in their crossfire, are now softening that, saying that at this stage it is not possible to determine who shot there. The Defense Minister, Benny Gantz, is now vowing an investigation, saying that he wants to do a joint investigation between Palestinians and Israelis. Wolf.
We'll stay on top of the story. Hadass Gold in Jerusalem, thank you very much. Up next, we're going to tell you about what's being called a miracle landing, how a man who had never flown a plane before actually wound up safely touchdown. Tonight, a nearly $1 billion settlement has been announced in the deadly collapse of that condo building last year in Surfside, Florida. An attorney for the victims' families says they've agreed on a tentative deal for $997 million. 98 people died when the building collapsed in the middle of the night last June. Also tonight, a unique plane landing. The pilot passed out, and the only other person on board had never flown a plane before. CNN's Carlos Suarez reports.
Caravan 333, Lima Delta, Fort Pierce Tower.
A new pilot has joined the ranks of heroes like Captain Sully.
I've got a serious situation here.
Except this guy's not a true pilot at all.
My pilot has gone incoherent. I have no idea how to fly the airplane.
Darren Harrison is a passenger who had to land this single-engine Cessna coming back from the Bahamas Tuesday after the pilot was incapacitated.
Number 333, Lima Delta, Roger, what's your position?
I have no idea. I see the coast of Florida in front of me, and I have no idea.
Soon enough, the plane was located on radar about 20 miles east of Boca Raton, Florida, and air traffic controller Robert Morgan was urgently called in from his break to help Harrison, who was suddenly in charge of landing a plane.
What was the situation with the pilot?
He is incoherent. He is out.
Number 3, Lima Delta, Roger. Try to hold the wings level and see if you can start descending for me. Push forward on the controls and descend at a very slow rate.
Morgan's been an air traffic controller for 20 years and is also a flight instructor. He took us up in his Cessna today to show us just how he helped Harrison get out of the air safely.
This is our propeller, which moves the blades.
Even giving me a chance at taking over the controls.
I've never done this before. You get the call.
Yeah.
What's the first thing that I need to do?
He was kind of like stable, right? He was already stable at 3,000. So you're just gonna grab the control wheel, gentle. Not a lot of pressure. It's like holding your first girlfriend's hand.
Teaching two novice pilots to fly in just 2 days' time.
So you have the control. So you're flying now.
If there was ever a moment of panic for either Morgan or Harrison, you would never know by listening to their calm exchange over the radio.
He was a really good listener.
And how good of a landing was it?
I would rate his landing a 10. So yeah. I've never flown that plane, and he landed it safely and didn't damage it and didn't damage. Nobody got hurt.
The two were definitely happy to see each other after the plane was on the ground.
You know, I was just about in tears. I didn't cry. I was trying to be strong and look very manly. But I kind of wanted to cry. It was just a lot of emotion. Gave him a big bear hug. Shook hands. I told him I owe him a cold beer. He said, no, I owe you a cold beer.
CNN's Carlos Suarez reporting. Thanks very much for that report. A good way to end our show. And to our viewers, thanks very much for watching. I'm Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room. Aaron Burnett out front starts right now.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.